The book was slender and rested inside a shallow compartment bathed in the still light of the stasis field. It was so old, almost as old as him. Together they were relics of another age, time lost things. In appearance, the book had nothing that suggested the power it possessed, but it was powerful, and so disruptive that Gilliman himself had banned it after Horace's betrayal. Every copy that could be found was burned, its words deemed tainted with the traitor's lies. It was expunged from history, scraped out of the record. People had died to protect it. The faithful called them martyrs, but the imperial cult had been small and ridiculous, and he had ignored it. By then, the damage had been done. The thoughts were out. A mimetic virus spread from mind to mind. It had no cure. The writings in this book, the thoughts and beliefs of an arch traitor, were the foundation of the imperial cult. 10,000 years after Lorgar Aurelian set pen to paper to create this tract, Gilliman began to read it. "Rejoice, for I bring you glorious news. God walks among us." So ran the first two lines of the Lectitio Divinitatis. The Imperium of Man, from the end of the Heresy through to the contemporary period, had suffered many a dark chapter. However, few instances could really rise to the level that actually requires such a classification than the likes of the Age of Apostasy. Now, I know that some of you out there often dislike my 15-minute introductions that lay a broader context of whatever it is I'm talking about, no matter how necessary I feel they actually are. So today, I thought let's mix it up. The Age of Apostasy occurred in M36, thousands of years after the Emperor was entombed upon the Golden Throne, and many millennia before Primarch Gilliman would return to the Imperium to lead it out of its dark, stagnating slump it found itself in. In essence, the apostasy was something approaching another civil war within the Imperium, but it was focused around the religious faction of the Ecclesiarchy, which had steadily grown in power over millennia. At this time, it had become problematic that a figure known as Gojs Vandaia simultaneously held the titles of High Lord of the Administratum and Ecclesiarch of the Adeptus Ministerium. Vandaia's reign was more commonly described as the Reign of Blood because of his tendency to exploit the Imperium's resources, impose brutal laws to consolidate power, which even extended to any who criticized or challenged him, who just disappeared. It was generally a period of corruption and zealous religious fanaticism, not to mention power grabs, fear-mongering, and general exploitation, not to mention, of course, gaslighting and misdirection of the populace. In short, it was a highly unstable period for the Imperium, and things became steadily more problematic until localized civil wars were breaking out as many began to attempt to resist Vandaia's urges, thus plunging the Imperium into widespread conflict and devastation. It also deals with the origins of the Adeptus Sororitas in this time and the reformation of the Ecclesiarchy into the form it now presents as in M41. Now that's the bare-bones framework, but it's obviously far more detailed and nuanced than such a short description. How it occurred and what it was a direct result of is also very interesting, and as I will explain in the next section, it is because of this, and this is the point of the video today, that it deserves considerable and further exploration, because the Age of Apostasy had massive consequences for the contemporary Imperium. It reinforced the theocratic nature, it highlighted the dangers of wildly unchecked authority, not to mention bearing just some resemblance to the warning signs of the Imperium not really being as controlled by humanity as it may wish to believe that it is and was, and that had been the case ever since the Emperor launched his crusade, but we will come to all of that a little later on. For me though, the reason the apostasy is one of the most interesting underexplored elements of the story of the Imperium is that in contrast to the Heresy, it is a far more human story. It focuses heavily on the more regular human aspects of the Imperium, and while of course there are legendary characters within the Heresy, it is dominated by the Astartes. The apostasy also occurs within a time period that sits somewhere in the middle between the Heresy and contemporary Imperium. So the apostasy really gives us an amazing opportunity to explore many of the questions and intriguing elements that persist to M41 and offer a foundational platform upon which to further develop the ideas about spirituality, the Emperor, and the power of this when wielded by those with deep fundamental faith in the worship of the Emperor of Mankind. As the galaxy of the Imperium in M41 registers with an ever-increasing audience, one thing I commonly find or hear is people trying to understand the narrative that exists beyond the initial entry points. You might find your way in from friends who enjoy the tabletop, games like Space Marine 2 and so on, but often the next question is, where do I begin learning more about the lore? Do I start at the Heresy? What specific book? What is the reading order, if there is one? Do I need to go in chronological order? Do I just go to YouTube? And so on. Now, my age-old advice is, of course, it doesn't matter, along with there are no spoilers in 40k. Heads up, the Emperor doesn't come out of the Heresy in a good state. Sorry to shock you with that one. So overall, it's because people expect there to be some kind of linear, well-connecting narrative that hits the major beats of events that unfold through to a modern point in time. So that's just very funny to me, the idea of any kind of linear, well-connecting narrative in 40k. And the problem with that is it doesn't exist, because you basically have very loose, vague references about things pre-Heresy, then the massive block of Heresy material, then you have middle stuff, and then it's M41. Maybe you go into Dawn of Fire, sort of is telling you the unfolding story now, but also, as I've spoken about endlessly, it's also in campaign stuff. It's just spread across all these different things. Tabletop supplements, audiobooks, shorts, narrative quotes on the side of codexes. It's all over the place. And that's often frustrating and confusing for people, because they didn't expect 40k to function as it does in terms of its unfolding lore, which is basically this mass jigsaw puzzle. But it's also because 40k is less a single cohesive narrative and more a vast, multifaceted platform for storytelling. The setting itself is in fact very much defined by the intricately constructed space that is very deliberately brimming with contradictions, apparent truths, seeds of possibility, layered conflicts that serve as fertile ground for countless individual narratives. So while one could argue that there is an overarching linear story primarily centered on the Emperor of Mankind, the journey of humanity in the form of the Imperium of Mankind, the masterwork of 40k lies in its ability to accommodate myriad perspectives and tales within this greater framework, and all while barely having to move the actual core narrative forward at all. And that's the glacial pace I'm always talking about. Yet even the central narrative of the Emperor and his rise and fall is often later fragmented and transformed by those within the Imperium. From the perspective of Imperial citizens, the story of the Emperor is as much a religious myth or fable as it is historical truth, so that individual storytellers can explore themes of faith, loyalty, the reliability of knowledge within the Imperium, which then always raises for me this topic of canonicity. Because again, you may find something you thought you knew earlier, but is then contradicted. Now, both sources are apparently seemingly viable, so which side do you fall on the side of? How do you contextualize that? It's an ongoing problem. And it's also what makes 40k amazing, because people like to discuss and interpret these things, and I wouldn't want it to be any other way, really. So while the Emperor's Saga and its tangent narratives form that framework, the verse of 40k itself operates more like a narrative sandbox. Within that, you have further factions, you've got Astartes, Orcs, the Eldar, and so on. And by doing so, it all allows us to view through a different lens things that we thought were certain or we had interpreted in a certain way, but suddenly now appear more blurred, indistinct, questionable. So I think just as we move into talking about these massive lore gaps that are ripe for harvesting, I want to establish once again that 40K is a setting where truth is very subjective, despite what some people might have you believe. And I know it doesn't sit well with some people, and I guess sorry for that, but unfortunately it is how 40K is, whether you like it or not. Which is why exploring topics within the Imperium's timeline is so interesting, because it enables us to potentially unpack, clarify, or further complicate and contradict the historical accuracy of such events by the muddled propaganda, religious dogma, and just the passage of so many millennia, in terms of the in-fiction historical events. Because that's what I am personally so invested in 40K for. It is all about these uncertainties that invite exploration and interpretation. I love things to be open-ended, and that allows us to decide how much of the lore is literal versus exaggerated legend, or just misinterpreted even by those who thought they witnessed it, all of which then falls relatively neatly into that rich bleakness that defines the 40K verse. It's the themes of decay, dystopian existential dread, the depressingly cyclical nature of humanity and its history, our inability to learn from past mistakes, which resonates across 40K narratives. It's about order versus chaos, survival versus extinction. All of this kind of material is timeless, whether it's heroic, grimdark, or just comically absurd, looking at you, orcs. But I really see all of this as very positive, because 40K was, for the longest time, in this agonizing state of stagnation. Nothing was moving forward narratively. And so it all felt somewhat pointless, because there were no stakes, nothing to explore beyond just theoretical, speculative questions. And quite honestly, it's why I did take a fairly decent break from 40K until prior to the refresh of 8th edition. I think I came back to the fray properly in 2015, because now, finally, 40K had once again become a verse that continued to exist in this bizarre narrative stasis, yet at the same time, it was also evolving again. And this is, again, a considerably unusual and defining feature of just what 40K is. It establishes chronological progression, events like the Great Rift, tearing the galaxy apart, Cadia, and so on, yet at its linear core, it still remains in this grim stasis. The Imperium does not meaningfully progress toward a better future. Rather, its stories explore how individuals and factions navigate that unchanging, perpetually chaotic balance of Xenos threat, struggle against their own status quo, and it's that stasis that ensures the universe remains so open-ended, whilst also providing a constant present. 40K is a storytelling engine. The lore, the factions, enable the writing of compelling stories, but through their nature of exploring humanity, will often engage us with philosophical questions that could appear in usually more serious, weighty material than you might imagine 40K to be. But that's what's enjoyable about it as well, because in some respects, this all could be seen as frustrating, muddled, too fragmented even, which is very understandable, especially if you are just coming into the world. But again, it's why I find personally 40K so captivating, because it's that sense of awe-inspiring, yet simultaneous bleak pointlessness and vastness, the completely absent or at best moral ambiguity, and the deeper specifically applied thematic richness that just makes 40K so very compelling. And all of that brings us to the aftermath of the heresy. In the aftermath of the heresy, there were the clear foundations of a religious following of the Emperor among the wider citizenry of the Imperium, as it was. And this was something that only a few years previous would have been unthinkable, a death sentence even. Yet, with the cataclysmic events of the heresy and the Siege of Terror, not to mention the extreme cost paid in its aftermath, there would finally be room for those who considered that there was more to the Emperor than him just being a powerful psyker, but basically human. Any who had espoused such views would still require the exercise of caution, to still stay below the radar of those who were currently purging everything in sight that looked heretical. But those who had seen with their own eyes the belief in the Emperor having a manifesting effect that had protected them needed little convincing and were committed to ensuring that others would hear their words, their faith, and expand their followers. Now, of course, the heresy has long stood as one of, if not the, defining events of the 40k verse, because it has it all, the traitors, loyalists, the Emperor, and his Primarchs, not to mention the cryptic events of those who surround the Master of Mankind, the kind of secondary storylines which are always ongoing. It has humanity struggling to define itself amid an era of superhuman, near-immortal warriors, somehow surviving and then having to re-establish itself. And all of this culminates in the ultimate apocalyptic tragedy that instead would be what actually defined humanity for the coming 10,000 years. And truly such a short summation barely begins to even scratch the surface of doing this any justice. In terms of material though, the heresy is now all but concluded. Certainly you have the scouring, there are various events which they have to discuss, there are many tangents you can go off on. But it has mostly come to its end in terms of the narrative series. Although, like I said, no doubt there's going to be more juice to milk yet. But we still haven't seen the complete end, the aftermath. Like I said, the installation of the Emperor upon the throne. Innumerable individuals waiting to tell their own specific tales, wrap them up. You still have events around the Primarchs, the Astartes, struggling to make sense of things. That would be very interesting to hear as well, them sort of discussing what the hell do they do now and so on. There's just many new burgeoning ideas and factions happening in that time, so there's masses of material to work with there. But something which keeps ticking over in my brain is the question of what will the next major series be? Will they continue on from the heresy, or will they tie that up in various bits and pieces which just come out kind of whenever? Do they instead launch into something else? Now, to be sure, things have been unfolding in M41 with the Dawn of Fire series, which I have been following and enjoying. Certainly it's not a banger with every installment of that, but then neither was the Heresy series. I personally can't recommend enough Gate of Bones. It's quite up there as a favourite 40k tale for me in many different ways, even though the actual story is relatively straightforward. But nonetheless, whilst the Dawn of Fire series has been interesting, I would hardly call it Heresy 2. It just can't compare, and I think that's largely due to the fact that although things are moving and unfolding, the stakes are arguably incredibly high. It just somehow doesn't feel that way. Which is strange when we obviously know the ending of the Heresy before it even began. And I don't think it's simply because now we're dealing with something in M41 that doesn't involve mass armies of superhuman destroyers going hard in brotherly slaughter. I think in M41, despite the immense despair, the threat the Imperium is facing, there is actually this overarching sense, this sliver of hope that things are turning. Gilliman returns, the Lion, the Emperor is stirring. It's all good, it's all interesting, but it also starts to slowly erode this dark sense of hopelessness that has so long existed and defines 40k. And this is something I have heard all too often is critically important for people who are just coming in new to 40k or who have lived with it for decades. It is that dark, gnawing sense that everything will end in darkness. It's the idea that all humanity's efforts are futile, because no matter what, the Emperor is a corpse on the throne. Humanity exists now, scrabbling around in the detritus of civilization that remains. And I think so, something like the apostasy would only distill that bleak horror into a narrative that is absolutely the grim darkness that defines 40k. And not only that, it would do so at a much more human level than something like the Heresy. And I know and hear that the human level of 40k is what people very, very much are interested in. But lastly, before we come to the apostasy, I want to remind once again that things are not always as they seem to be in the lore of 40K. It is all about context, context. Someone coming in new might not be aware, for example, that Lord Gilliman struggles greatly with the fact that in M41, the Ecclesiarchy has penetrated every possible layer of Imperial society. The suffocating presence of religion within the Imperium is completely inescapable, so much so that every ordinary Imperial citizen now believes that the Emperor must be and has always been venerated as an immortal, omnipotent god. Now that is what the citizenry of M41 believe. We understand this to be entirely incorrect, and it's a good example of that in-fiction contextualization, because at the dawn of the Emperor's Great Crusade, there was no state religion, no ministerium, no ecclesiarchy. The Imperium was about as far away from having those things as it was possible to be. The Emperor had waged war in exterminating all those who preached such beliefs, and then outlawed organized worship of anything and anyone in any form. This was, of course, in part because the Emperor understood that there was a significant danger in allowing the idea of worship in more ways than one. But there is always the undercurrent of there being some other reasoning. The Imperial truth told of secular society, one which denied all spirituality and would rely on the science and technological mastery that humanity had once held and could achieve again. But was this all misdirection? The Emperor himself was a powerful being, a supreme example of the end point for humanity, but not a deity, not a figure of worship. Now, I know you're thinking, oh, here he goes again. No, I'm being very restrained today. I already have content about the Emperor and his divinity. It's all part of the ongoing Emperor series, so you can check that if you haven't before. But suffice to say, during the Great Crusade, we know how the Emperor sought to unify humanity under the secular ideals of his imperial truth, the espoused views rejecting superstition, mythological figures, power religion, etc. And that's fine. Except it's hard to argue that while you yourself walk around as a giant man dressed in gold, inspiring awe, if not causing people's heads to explode by just speaking with them, this is where the debate comes about the nature of his existence and just how sincere the Emperor really was about saying, no, I'm not really a god. Was the Emperor blind to the quite obvious interpretations that humans were going to make? Or was this part of a greater plot to deny his divinity and therefore only further inspire those who already had begun to see him as more than a mere mortal? His deeds, power, and the aura of immortality created a very inevitable slide toward reverence in not only humans, but also the transhuman creations of his, the Astartes. Even one of his primarchs, Lorgar of the Wordbearers, his belief in the Emperor would give rise to one of the most critical works in human history, the Lectitio Divinitatis. And again, it has had such a strong impact upon human culture that it begins to beg the question, did the Emperor foresee any of this? There are, I think, many signs that he in fact did so. The cult was, in the beginning, little more than a loose band of individuals who declared the Emperor to be a divine being, spread in secret through copies or fragments of this tome authored by Lorgar. They huddled in the depths of Imperial ships, dark corners, back rooms upon hive worlds. For the risk of speaking such musings publicly risked terminal consequences. The Wordbearers themselves would of course notoriously see the painful consequences for those who openly worshipped the Emperor in the destruction of Monarchia. Their brutally public chastising by the Emperor himself in person. These events caused a great malaise among the Wordbearers to take hold. They drifted, sulked, and were unsure of a direction to take in the aftermath of this. And it would be during this drifting, lost period that they would fall into the darkness that would lead to the broader rebellion against the Emperor in the Heresy, and even sow the seeds for later theological schisms. The influence of Lorgar's works continue even into M41. as unbelievably, Roberto Guillemin holds a copy of the Lectitio Divinitatis. One of the key figures toward the end of the heresy, and one of the most influential proponents of the emperor's divinity, was Euphrati Keeler. Now, Keeler was a remembrancer. They are tasked with documenting the Great Crusade, and she had begun her journey as an ardent follower of the imperial truth. And like so many in this time, she was a clear-minded, objective individual dedicated to the ideals of logic and reason. However, her secular strength wavered as over time she began to witness events which defied all rational explanation, not least that on several occasions she was able to survive situations that were unexplainable, proximity to traitor primarchs, evading death, and so on. It's speculated by many, and I personally agree, that throughout the heresy she was unknowingly being protected by the emperor through a fragment aura of his powers, because we well understand that, like some powerful psychers like Tigurius, the emperor is able to reach out at great distances and influence his power onto individuals who may not even be aware that he's doing so. Now, if that were true, it adds to the argument that the emperor knew potentially his fate, or at least that he understood that he had to place individuals in certain specific points at certain times in order for a specific thread of events to come to pass. Which leads us then into considering that it was critical now for him to stoke the fires of faith and worship amid humanity, for only through this could he become empowered in M41. The pivotal moment for Keeler occurred during the Siege of Terror, where she had attempted to save any ordinary human she could from the apocalyptic scale of slaughter taking place by the Astartes. The proto-imperial cultists had been granted a sort of temporary pardon by Malkador, who could see their worship of the Emperor but wished also to see if their faith could prove useful in combating the forces of Chaos. And so Keeler led this pilgrimage of survivors in an exodus from the Imperial Palace, which seemed close to destruction at the hands of the traitors. As to her destination, she stated not to know, only that she was following a guiding light, avoiding death at the hands of Horus's own legion. She would encounter the Imperial Fists, Templars of Sigismund, who joined with Keeler to where she then would lead them into the refuge known as the Hollow Mountain, a place she could not have possibly known or accessed from her own experience. Seemingly, she was led there by something. A last stand was made against the Death Guard assault led by Typhus, and all seemed lost. However, Keeler was able to lead the wailing, despairing human masses in what really was the first sacrificial prayer amongst those of faith. She was able to unite those who were only just learning of it, and even those who maybe did not truly believe, but had also little to lose. This effort of the faithful throngs caused such an unseen and unexpected psychic backlash. It not only threw back the Death Guard, but it even unbelievably reactivated the Astronomicon. In the aftermath, Keeler and Sigismund would give prayer to the now enthroned Emperor. This event was effectively the beginning of the religious worship of the Emperor. It was their ability in their faith to draw on his immense psychic power, something that would be seen later prominently utilized by those among the Adeptus Sororitas. In the time of the Siege of Terror, it is more likely that they were literally drawing on his residual exuding power. In the time of M41, it is not necessarily clear whether faith literally enables people to be empowered by the Emperor's own psychic power. It's not clear if that's the case, but nonetheless, it still has a very profound effect in terms of those who have faith being enabled with powers, like Sororitas, for example, being able to fly or be resurrected. So it was very self-evident that the Emperor's divine protection had saved Keeler and all those who had followed with her and had faith in their hearts. So that was a very powerful event, and something which then would be, of course, told and retold for thousands of years. She would later become known as the first saint of what would become the Imperial Creed. Her transformation from a chronicler to a religious figure also marked a turning point in the development of the Lectitio Divinitatis in terms of its engagement with humanity. Her close associate also, Karel Sindemann, who was a former iterator during the heresy. They were figures who preached the imperial truth upon worlds Imperium conquered during the heresy. They were there to smooth transition from independent worlds into them being under the banner of the Imperium. They were adept in diplomacy, mastery of academic matters. And they were individuals whose very identity was the imperial truth, the secular imperial truth. Yet even for these figures like Sindemann, witnessing events throughout the heresy, it started to shift their viewpoint, their thinking. Sindemann, for example, at one point inadvertently summoned a demon from the Book of Lorgar. That was a work written by Lorgar, which came as his second after the Primarch had decided that the Emperor was no longer the divine being he had earlier proclaimed. This tome was a far more heretical work, covered in runes, the insane scrawlings of a Primarch lost to the darkness of the warp. In essence, Sindemann had just seen too much, but it also reinforced his turn from secularism to the faith in the Emperor. Because Sindemann would preach with Keeler for a time, ultimately he would become a founding member of what would become the Inquisition. Now, a small tangent aside, it's understandable that a series like Cyphus Cain, The Beast Arises, some of these older, long series, are very daunting to look into, as they're often long, ongoing novel series like The Heresy, but they don't have quite that grandeur of The Heresy. But I wanted to note how in The Beast Arises series, you get many more fragments of information about what happens with Karel Sindemann. And this is very common for 40K novels, that information is seeded throughout some other adjacent broader campaign. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that if you wanted to find out what happens to Sindemann, and I will probably mention it more specifically in some individual character-driven video at some point down the line. But ultimately, what we know is that Keeler's charismatic influence and ability to inspire others caused this explosion of faith after the heresy, and the word of the Lectitia Divinitatis would flourish. Her writings, sermons preached the Emperor's divine nature, his role as humanity's saviour, and how their faith had very literally saved them. I think it's also very important to note and understand that much of humanity, including the Astartes, were completely despairing and broken at this time. Their saviours turned upon them, the Emperor was nowhere to be seen, brothers fought against brothers, thousands of worlds across the Imperium burned. So this new sudden worship of the saviour Emperor resonated very deeply with many citizens, soldiers, even some imperial officials. It gave them something to cling on to. For despite the Emperor's explicit rejection of such worship, many cults and sects would just still arise regardless. For while these groups differed in their practices, they shared a common veneration for the Emperor as a god. Keeler would become the spiritual leader of this now burgeoning faith, guiding its growth even in the face of opposition. But of course, the rise of the Emperor worshipping cults did not occur without resistance. There were still vast numbers who firmly believed in the imperial truth and who wished to remain loyal to the Emperor's vision of a secular imperium. So much so that comically at this time they still viewed the Emperor worshipping cultists as heretics. Unsurprisingly, the ideological divide would erupt into violence, and that only further destabilized the Imperium during what is still the aftermath of its greatest crisis. Euphrati Keeler's legacy, though, extended far beyond the heresy itself. She would become the first saint of the Imperial Creed. Her contributions to the spread of emperor worship laid the foundation of what would later become the Adeptus Ministerium, the official state religion of the Imperium. However, the imperial creed of the Emperor was not the ultimate form for the religious state of the Imperium in M41. In the subsequent decades post-heresy, as stated, numerous cults of the faithful emerged. They all had their very specific nuances, undoubtedly some of those who began such practices were doing so for their own self-benefit, but generally they were focused upon themes of devotion, redemption, and salvation through the Emperor's self-sacrifice. And while they varied in their practices and strength of beliefs in specific areas, overall, of course, they shared this common reverence for the divine God Emperor. As more time passed, these groups began to steadily unify, collapse, or just be forcibly amalgamated under the single movement, which would become known as the Temple of the Saviour Emperor. This group gained such strength and presence that it would eventually absorb effectively all smaller cults into its fold. And this unification process came from a position of both being ideologically and practically aligned, because the temple's structure and doctrines offered a fairly cohesive framework for worship that could be universally deployed across the vast and now fractured Imperium. Within a few centuries, the Temple of the Saviour Emperor would become the dominant religious organization representing the majority of humanity's faith. But the apostasy would not take place until M36. Now, in early M32, the temple achieved formal recognition as the official state religion of the Imperium, adopting the title now of the Adeptus Ministerium. So this was extremely significant in the history of the Imperium, because it marked the official point at which, in all the centuries post-heresy, this was now where faith became deeply intertwined, embedded within the governance and identity of the Imperium. But at this point, it would function still very much as one component of the broader Imperium, much as we might see today. It's just one section. Yet by M41, the religious body of the Ministerium has swallowed every aspect of Imperial life, to where there exists now almost no aspect of the Imperium which exists untouched by those who worship the God Emperor, save for, of course, some of the Astartes Inquisition definitely, and the Mechanicus. But back in M32, with its newfound authority, the Ministerium also would embark upon what would become synonymous with its identity hereafter. Because until now, it had remained largely a body which preached to the faithful and then just attempted to grow its numbers, to become more influential, to be taken more seriously, and certainly not to be seen as being problematic. But by M32, it had become so powerful that it was able to begin exerting more leadership, use its power, to the point at which it could now launch widespread purges of any of those remaining independent cults. It would declare them heretical threats to its unity and dangerous to the Imperium. Most would be eradicated, a few were driven underground, but this was the moment that set a precedent that would continue all the way through to M41, that the state religion of the Imperium no longer was benign. It would take any action necessary to ensure its power and to unquestionably enshrine the Emperor as the singular divine figurehead of the Imperium, because anybody who dared state otherwise risked execution as a heretic. Now, I did almost omit this section, but it seemed important enough given the role of the material even through to M41 to at least make a further mention of it. As we know, the Lectio Divinitatis began as this highly controversial work during the Great Crusade. It was authored by the Wordbearer's Primarch, Lorgar. It described the Emperor's divinity. It presented him as humanity's saviour, not only in a temporal sense, but as its spiritual guide. It described him as a godlike being who existed far above humanity, dealing more with the metaphysical. So almost inevitably, even despite the Emperor's violent rejection of belief, because it was antithetical to his vision of a rational secular Imperium, the Divinitatis could not be just erased from human culture. It was copied, it was fragmented, it was spread throughout the Imperium. Its message was stark, and it reframed the Emperor and all he sought to achieve. And that resonated deeply with citizens, soldiers of the Imperium, and it only ever became more true during the times of strife and uncertainty that was soon to follow. And you see that in the Siege of Terror and how humans there are dealing with what they are seeing, because very much the Emperor is the only thing they have left to cling onto when quite literally reality is collapsing all around them. So by the end of the Horus Heresy, this sense of faith in the Emperor was becoming very widespread, entrenched even at that point. The scale of atrocity and tragedy that had befallen humanity, and indeed Terra itself, was so monumental that even those such as Malkador had begun to tolerate the prospect of a religious following, because they were curious as to the potential it could have as a weapon against the horrors of the warp, something which was very much demonstrated by Euphrates Keeler. So the number of those who would then count themselves among the faithful at this time is extraordinarily difficult to estimate. a likely safe bet could be somewhere in the millions, not all on Terra, off-world as well. Lorgar, in many ways, laid the foundation of, and arguably shaped the Imperium that was to come, which certainly sits well within the bleak, despairing comedy of 40K that I so enjoy, and which frames the galaxy of the Imperium. Because in the 41st millennium, the Lectitia Divinitatis has maintained a profound influence through its institutional evolution as what is now called the Imperial Creed. It remains one of the most powerful unifying forces within the Imperium and pervades every aspect of life at all levels. Now, quite obviously, it is not referred to as the Lectitia Divinitatis written by Lorgar. That would be very heretical. But nonetheless, its teachings inspire bespoke rituals among the nobility, mandatory prayer readings preached to the lowliest hive workers, grand ceremonies of the High Imperium, events that could take many days, even weeks, to complete. So its doctrines shape the policies, culture, and motivations of the Imperium itself, bring stability, determination, and most of all, unwavering loyalty to the Emperor through reverence, fear, and awe. Even if, hilariously, all of those who follow this do not recall its origin. The Ecclesiarchy is born of the teachings from the Divinitatis, even, like I say, if they have been rewritten, reinterpreted. And it is so incredibly comical that the work of Lorgar has continued this immense influence. You could even say it rivals the power of those most crucial imperial institutions like the Mechanicus or the Administratum. But the faith does not merely unify, it also controls. The belief that the Emperor's will is channeled through the Ecclesiarchy allows the Ministerium to dictate everything from military crusades to planetary resource allocations, pilgrimages, relic veneration, crusades, tithes, all are justified through the lens of serving the Emperor's divine plan. Entire wars of faith are waged under the pretense of fulfilling his holy purpose. And the Imperial Creed ensures that loyalty to the Emperor supersedes all other consideration. It shapes the minds of Imperial commanders and planetary governors. It has massive influence on current leadership, policies, how they approach almost everything that occurs at a planetary, system, and sector level for the Imperium. Even the Astartes, who were originally very adherent to the secular Imperial truth, have been influenced by the Lectitia Divinitatis. You've got chapters like the Black Templars, who openly embrace the Emperor's divinity, something which is, of course, extraordinarily problematic for Robertier Gilliman, because the Templars' actions are guided by this religious zeal rather than strategic pragmatism, which was classic for the Space Marines. And that shift really illustrates just how deeply the cult's beliefs have permeated even institutions designed to remain above all such influence. What was very interesting about the return of Robertier Gilliman was his depression that he had upon seeing the state the Imperium was in and how problematic the spread of the Ecclesiarchy has been. For the now Lord Commander of the Imperium, it created a great problem. It created this intriguing tension between the reality of the Imperium in M41 and the Emperor's original vision. Gilliman himself would be a staunch proponent of the Imperial truth, yet now finds himself having to lead an Imperium which is completely transformed after 10,000 years of indoctrinated faith. Yet very obviously, Gilliman understands he cannot just purge the Imperium of these religious worshippers. It would be destructive, if not the end of humanity, were he to do so. He's entirely pragmatic. He understands the necessity of the Imperial Creed in maintaining unity across the very fractured, embattled Imperium, which is just about clinging on to its very survival. But there are even indications that Lectitia Divinitatis influences even Gilliman's decisions. For while he might personally reject the notion of the Emperor as a god, he has begun to explore, like Malkador, the power of faith, how it can inspire, mobilize billions of citizens and soldiers. Originally, he was very dismissive of those like the preachers, who he considered as just kind of trivial and annoying, something to be bothered by. But during the conflicts that Gilliman has been engaged within since his return, similarly to Kyrell Sinderman and others, Gilliman has witnessed events and actions which have made him question this secular reality. He understands the demonic powers of chaos. He sees the incomprehensible protections offered to those of the faithful. And in the mind of Gilliman, with his theoretical and his practical approach to things, this is creating a lot of problems, because he is unable to rationalize a sufficient explanation as to just what is taking place here. Perhaps more comically, Gilliman's speeches and declarations that he gives to the Imperium in M41, whilst from his perspective he retains a very secular tone, his words will often be interpreted by those of the Imperial Creed as being very spiritual. They just see whatever they want to see, which is very normal for those of the Ecclesiarchy. And it just further entwines his actions with the faith of the Imperium. There are scholars and preachers who are constantly taking his words, adding their own embellishments, spreading the word. And this is very problematic for Gilliman, but there's not really anything he can do about it. The fact that he is becoming embedded himself as a religious figure within the Imperium, because of course he is a son of the Emperor. He is the son of the God Emperor. So for Gilliman, he sees this enduring influence of the Lactitia Divinitatis, and perhaps more broadly, the work of Lorgar, who of course we know historically, Gilliman and Lorgar were not exactly the best of friends, which creates this very interesting situation where Gilliman returns but has to now face this dichotomy. He has to navigate a realm where rational leadership is constantly hampered by dogmatic adherence to a faith that he doesn't share. It blinds and stagnates the Imperium to innovation, the flexibility that it needs to address the immense challenges that are right on its doorstep. Because faith in the Imperium shapes every decision made, from the deployment of fleets to the structure of their society. It creates this environment where belief and action are inextricably linked, whether that's through inspiring acts of heroism, fostering stagnation that Gilliman is so desperately seeking to overcome. And it's this legacy of the Lactitia Divinitatis that remains one of the defining forces of the Imperium in the 41st millennium. The Temple of the Saviour Emperor was one of the early cults that emerged from the consolidated beginnings of emperor worship. Unlike many of the other cults that rose to believe in the God Emperor, the temple was based on Terra itself. And this gave the significant advantage of being able to further entrench its power, as it could preach at the very centre of the Imperium, humanity, and the resting place of the Emperor himself. Originally led by a man said to have been a dedicated high-ranking officer of the Imperial Army, and who even fought in the defence of the Imperial Palace during the Horus Heresy. The temple gathered a massive following, and this allowed them to be proactive in spreading the cause and words of the temple throughout the galaxy. Officers inducted their soldiers into the cult, and missionaries moved among hive world populations. So that within as little as a century, there were said to be billions of followers of the temple. People flocked to count themselves among the numbers, for the appeal of spiritual cleansing and unity was great among those who were left shattered in the wake of the terrible events of the heresy. Early in the 32nd millennium, it was said that as much as 2/3 of the Imperium now worshipped with the temple, so that by the end of the first half of the 32nd millennium, the temple was recognized as the official religion of the Imperium and was given the title of Adeptus Ministrorum. From then on, power and influence of the Ministrorum would grow until it became a total part of everyday life for all the members of the Imperium. Only a few centuries would pass before then they were even represented among humanity's highest authority. Ecclesiarch Venerus became a High Lord of Terra, and the importance and power of the Ecclesiarchy now expanded exponentially. Soon thereafter, the permanence of the Ministrorum could not be questioned, and so the Ecclesiarch's seat on the Council of the High Lords was made permanent forevermore. As the Adeptus Ministrorum expanded, a dedicated hierarchy managed the logistics of constructing shrines and temples, overseeing the collection and tithes across the Imperium. However, there was still resistance, even now. The Confederation of Light was a penitent sect preaching that humanity should live minimally and with humility. Because of this, they were directly opposed to the Ecclesiarchy's wealth and grandeur. Resistant to Ministrorum missionaries, the Ecclesiarch launched the First War of Faith, completely crushing the opposing religious sect. By the end of M33, the Ecclesiarchy's dominance was now absolute, funded by vast tithes that they used to build lavish temples and wage even further wars of faith. A small aside, you'll often hear these terms crusade and war of faith thrown around. They're not entirely the same thing, but they also overlap. But the major differences are really the origins and who participates in them. A crusade is ordered by the authority of all High Lords of Terra, or now the Lord Commander, and generally involves all the different organisations of the Imperium. That could be Space Marines, Imperial Guard, the Imperial Navy, Ministerium, the Adeptus Terra, whereas a War of Faith is ordered by the Ecclesiarch alone and primarily concerns only the members of the Ministerium and its followers. But confusion comes because of the overlap. Most often a crusade is generally targeted towards problems that are considered to be an affront against the Emperor. This means they'll most likely also be declared a War of Faith by the Ecclesiarch at the same time. When a War of Faith is singularly announced, the Ecclesiarch will state the objectives of the war, the heretical targets of the Emperor's vengeance. Space Marine Crusades are their own thing entirely, and those are never Wars of Faith. But true Wars of Faith exist when the Ecclesiarchy singularly engages with an enemy for the sake of its beliefs, rather than to just, say, quell a rebellion or purge some Xenos-held planet. So, when not part of a crusade, wars of faith are funded and organized by the Ecclesiarchy. They contain only warriors from the Sororitas and authorized Fraternis militia. In the earlier period of the emerging Ministerium, though, they could declare such wars of faith alone. Now, in M41, the Ecclesiarch does not have supreme authority to order just wars of faith whenever they feel like it. The adventure must be approved by the other High Lords of Terra, and now, yes, the Lord Commander. So wars of faith can be conducted against undesignated targets also. For example, an exploratory fleet may be sent to underexplored regions of the galaxy, and this could comprise a multitude of different task forces, including missionaries, and then those who stand alongside them to protect, as much as they are to just bring the light of the Emperor to the faithless, and they may find themselves engaged in a war of faith along the way. Now, moving from M32 to 34, the Adeptus Ministerium now held near total power over not just the religion of the Imperium, but indeed the Imperium of Man itself. But this was really only still a precursor to the later problems that would arise. The Temple of the Savior Emperor had become the bureaucratic backbone of the Imperium in M34, and certainly held some overlap with responsibilities of the Administratum just by the nature of things. But what would follow would then be several millennia between the two where they struggle for supremacy over the governance of humanity. The influence wielded by the Ecclesiarch was just immense, and this was only made doubly problematic by the fact that whoever occupied that position was then widely regarded as the voice of the Emperor. So there was a perception that granted the Ecclesiarch a quasi-divine authority, which extended for obvious reasons way beyond just spiritual matters, and that effectively made them arbitrarily the most influential figure within the High Lords of Terra, basically the de facto ruler of the Imperium. Now again, for very obvious reasons, that created a slow-burning discontent among the other High Lords, their departments, and the Imperial bureaucracy. Because the Ecclesiarchs wielded such absolute power, they were able to basically dictate the Imperium's direction. They could levy massive tithes, drain planetary economies to just fund the Ecclesiarchy's massive construction projects. They could engage in disruptive internal bureaucratics and then decadent expansions. Similarly, they could also enforce sweeping legal changes and just redirect military forces, including fleets and armies, to just wage wars of faith or eliminate perceived threats to their power, which may well have not actually been the best use of those forces. So effectively, the Ministerium had begun to display and represent the very worst traits of humanity, which was both very embarrassing and actively problematic for the direction and safety of the Imperium. So by the time we reach M36, this relentless power struggle between the Ministerium and Administratum had been going on for a considerably long period of time, and it defined much of the Imperium's internal politics now. Each was vying to assert more prominent control, flex its own political muscle. It was effectively a cold war within the Imperium. And where previously aid may have been forthcoming for the betterment of all, the administratum or ecclesiarchy now may seek to restrict or hold back anything that could cast the other in a favourable light, or they may enact things which would cast themselves in a favourable light to their own followers. Any expense or human suffering caused as a result was really nothing they were concerned about. So it was very clear that these were the signs of a governmental bureaucracy in its death throes. For when such systems begin to put their own self-serving interests above the greater good, or spend more time fighting among themselves, well then you are witnessing the collapse of a system no longer fit for purpose, morally bankrupt, or worse, a precursor to civil war. All of this was not at all improved by the fact that the Ministerium's ability to command such sweeping authority had already inflicted a suppurating wound within the Imperium for basically thousands of years. The concentration of power in the hands of the Ecclesiarch had over many millennia led to an unprecedented scale of corruption, misrule, decay, competing ambitions repeatedly destabilizing the Imperium, threatening its already fragile survival. So when one Goge Vandire became the new Ecclesiarch in M36, the stage was set for the darkest period in human history since the heresy, the Age of Apostasy. Now, as much as I would love to give you a really surgically detailed extraction of the apostasy, the entire point of this video today is that this is something we still need to see, because the apostasy itself has only been referenced in the form of historical overviews. The real deep lore, the character lore that we still await, I hope we are setting the stage for, because it needs to be made clear just how epic and necessary it is for us to further explore the many deep, rich veins of lore that can exist in this time. The greatest cause of the apostasy was the failure for the specific branches of the Imperium to work together, and one could argue this was the great failing of human leaders, and certainly it's even why in M41, when Gilliman returned, he saw the poor state of affairs and despaired. He basically just said, enough. But this was only part of the problem. The misrule that by M36 had reached its apex allowed corrupt ideologues to manipulate and misrepresent the Emperor's teachings to pursue their own ambitions for absolute power. The conflict between the two had pushed the Ministerium to take ever more severe actions, so that by the time Ecclesiarch Benedin IV came into power, he would relocate their official chambers to Ophidia VII. This was far from Terra in Segmentum Tempestus, primarily because it was one of the wealthiest planets after Terra and Mars. The immense scale of the palaces here covered some 90,000 square miles, many towered 4,000 meters high. It was rivaled only by the Imperial Palace on Terra, and critically, this meant that the Ministerium was now isolated from the Administratum. The Ecclesiarchy had effectively separated itself from those on Terra and founded their own new territory. This move was also accompanied by relentless tithes, cardinals competing to build ever grander monuments, purging heretical cults intensified, and the Ecclesiarchy also formed now its own military, the Fraternis Templars. These would eventually rival the Imperial Guard regiments in strength, equipment, and training. Its structures on Terra, meanwhile, decayed in its absence. So stark this was that it was a humiliating problem which could not easily be covered with standard Imperial propaganda. The Imperium became further destabilized. However, this self-imposed exile actually only lasted for 300 years. When Ecclesiarch Gregor XI was elected, he shocked the Holy Synod of the Ministerium by announcing their return to Terra, because it was his strong-held belief that humanity's faith was with the Emperor upon the homeworld. And I think it's worth to mention that within the Ministerium, the Ecclesiarchy, it wasn't totally disingenuous. Of course, they held very, very strong religious beliefs, their faith, so it wasn't all entirely personal and disgusting, they just were making kind of relatively bad choices most of the time. and he believed that the Ministerium's place was upon terror, no matter the disruptive struggles that they were having with the bureaucracy. So it was that despite strong opposition from the other cardinals and powerful voices within the Ministerium, they returned. The move took 12 years, and it significantly drained their resources, thus forcing ever harsher tithes to fund the restoration of Terra's palaces. Gregor began planning radical reform, but then died before implementing them. 6 million mourners attended his funeral, and his successor quickly restored the ecclesiarchy's conservative traditions, halting any changes. So things took a downward turn from there. Driven by the insatiable demands of the cardinals, the ecclesiarchy would once again raise tithes. As a result, the unthinkable then occurred. Widespread unrest erupted throughout the worlds of the Imperium. Citizens pushed too far began to rebel. Even planetary governors refused to pay, condemning the Ministerium's greed. It was all now out in the open. The religious heart of the Imperium's response to all of this? Careful consideration of the spiritual needs of the people, perhaps? A respectful climb down, buffered by propaganda? Nope. The ecclesiarchy instead chose brutal reprisals. The Ministerium armies crushed revolts, planetary officials were executed as heretics, and even the Officio Assassinorum were utilised to remove governors who had begun diverting funds to their own defences. The argument for all of this would be that they had forsworn the Emperor's protection for their own worldly gains. Within their bubble of safety on Terra, the Ministerium and Ecclesiarch extracted ever greater tithes now and used it to fund ever grander temples, endless statues of past ecclesiarchs, lavish decorations forged from rare metals and jewels. All dissenters were declared heretics and punished or executed with merciless efficiency. As the Imperium entered the 36th millennium, the Imperium was visibly fracturing. It was so destabilized and violent that even warp storms began to appear with regularity. Planets were being isolated. The situation was dire, yet neither the Administratum or Ecclesiarchy would yield, because both were far too embittered and committed to their struggle for power that they were completely blinkered and couldn't see anything else. Unsurprisingly, the enemies of humanity would seize upon this moment of weakness. Raiders surged from the Eye of Terra, ravaging nearby planets. Orc warlords ransacked Hive cities and ran unchecked across the galaxy. Isolated worlds were just consumed by warp horrors, and emergent cults of the four-armed emperor began to appear. Human exploitation was certainly no less of an issue, as dissenters and those who sought to break free from the Imperium seized upon the moment. Planetary governments were overthrown, populations rose up to throw off the shackles of the nobility. Many were condemned to slaughter or worse, but it massively damaged the production and again stability of the Imperium. Even those most stable worlds began to fracture without guidance from the Adeptus Ministerium. Those of faith once again fragmented into warring cults and sects. Once loyal followers turned against each other in brutal struggles over how to interpret worship of the Emperor. An all too familiar, suffocating, pre-apocalyptic gloom smothered the Imperium. This all felt like ground that had been trodden too many times previous, and should have been left to the annals of history. Yet as is all too commonly seen, humanity does not excel in learning from its own history, and is condemned so tragically to repeat obvious paths to collapse again and again. Zealots began to openly denounce now the ecclesiarchy, claiming that the Emperor had unleashed these warp storms to punish them for their greed, and this was a test for the true believers. Fear was a plague which now ran unchecked throughout the Imperium. Nobody knew which side to take. Citizens turned to ever more extreme solutions, believing that they had in some way caused these events through their lack of faith, or some other personal or community shortcomings. Those who exhibited even the slightest deviations from the faith were pursued and put to the flame. Whole families were executed, entire hive sectors massacred for perceived corruption and heresy. Ever more brutal penance became more common also. Self-flagellation and mutilation in public became common by those who sought to prove their devotion. Entire populations devolved into despair-driven cults, each striving to outdo others in their torturous piety. Radical sects inevitably gained power, inciting mobs who, in a zealous frenzy, slaughtered scores of innocents in a desperate attempt to appease the emperor. For this was the age of apostasy. Now, a common mistake I see, and I'm sure you see, is about the infamous figure known as Gauge Vandaya. Because I always see Vandaya being spoken about as if he were an out-of-control member of the Ecclesiarchy, which of course he was not. Gauge Vandaya began as a member of the Administratum, but I think it's easy to understand where the confusion comes from given that this period is so heavily about the Ecclesiarchy falling out of control and the power grabs that followed, so it's very understandable that things can be mixed up. But it is also, again, one of those perfect things whereby the fog of lore and imperial history ends up becoming a slightly twisted version, which is then repeated over and over, and it's just amazing how 40k is reflected in reality. So, Gauge Vandaya was the 361st High Lord of the Administratum. He had a very hard reputation from the outset and was a strong critic of the Ecclesiarchy's dominance. He was also greatly feared, even before the worst offences of his reign came to pass, and many believed that he had used assassins and other politically corrupt means to manipulate his way into the rank of High Lord. How he had done so, never entirely clear, very likely he had some leverage somewhere. Vandaya was entirely ruthless, and none within the Administratum dared oppose him. Yet just prior to assuming this position as High Lord of the Administratum, Vandaya had exploited the chaotic situation that had been ongoing for so long to orchestrate an election of a new head of the Ministerium, one Ecclesiarch Pauli III, a figure who it would soon become clear was easily controlled by Vandaya and his allies. Such actions would never have been possible in the past, as the Ministerium was too strong and the Imperium still operating with some sense of decorum and due process. But as things began to fragment and collapse, all normal order ceased, and Vandaya just used the opportunity to seize power and remove problems caused by the Ecclesiarchy and its followers. Once secure in his position, Vandaya openly then moved to seize the Ecclesiarchy with an elite hand-picked Imperial Guard force. He staged a coup and made a farcical show of the arrest and execution of Pauli III as a traitor. It was only then that Vandaya would now claim both titles of High Lord of the Administratum and Ecclesiarch. He now had an entirely unprecedented scale of power, not seen since the days of the Heresy, because in effect he was now the singular commander of the Imperium. Soon after, the blood would continue to be spilled. Any within the Ministerium who opposed him were swiftly removed. Many within the Ministerium fled to Ophelia 7 in a bid to escape the High Lord's wrath. Yet comically, and not without some irony, their ship upon entering the warp was engulfed by a huge storm. The cardinals and synod of the Ministerium were lost forever. Their fate? Well, probably best not to think about that. Vandaya, of course, could not believe his luck, and claimed it was, of course, the will of the Emperor. This was surely and blatantly clear evidence of his divine right to reign over the Imperium. He installed cardinals of his own, his perfect mix of weak fools and masterful manipulators, all of whom were undoubtedly already subservient to him, or who he held some power over. Family information, scandal, cruel threats, and so on. So were it not already perfectly clear, Vandaya was completely insane. His myriad personality issues only made worse by his complete lack of any kind of human moral compass, empathy, or just any care at all other than to just consolidate power and inflict cruel punishments upon his enemies. He was greatly paranoid, sociopathic, and consumed by delusions of grandeur. He imagined endless plots that sought to overthrow him. Many of these could have been true, but just as many were pure fiction. He only believed what he wanted to or what suited him. He tortured victims under the guise of purifying their souls for the Emperor. He demanded every word he spoke be recorded, surrounding himself with scribes who documented his ramblings and brutal extended sessions of torture in the catacombs beneath the ecclesiarchal palace. His moods would swing violently from manic laughter to murderous rage. He often was seen to be mumbling under his breath, the next minute shouting in an uncontrolled, incomprehensible state, often seemingly at himself. Soon thereafter, Vandire began to claim that he would hear the Emperor's voice. It's entirely possible that this was even true, but it could equally have been just his own imagination. Either way, I'm sure that he truly believed it. His position of power was so total that Vandire became completely obsessed with micromanagement and regional control. He spent inordinate periods of time within his vast audience chamber that he had constructed. It featured a massive tri-dimensional map of the Imperium, and as soon as a world became accessible from subsiding warp storms, he dispatched war fleets to seize it. Sycophantic officers indulged this madness. Outlawed weapons were utilized in virus bombing without cause. He ordered entire planets' child populations to live lives of servitude, and elsewhere he had the ice caps of planets melted, causing the deaths of billions. In one instance of this era, on the hive world of Lestrati, a fanatical divine army seized control and soon began to inflict a brutal code of life among the populace. Dissenters were horrifically tortured and executed, while amid the general population, far worse awaited. Genetically engineered viruses were used to wipe out those who didn't fit their ideal of humanity. Millions were enslaved, forced to toil in factories and mineral extraction in totally inhumane conditions. Many worked without food or water until death. Corpses piled so high that workers were tasked with burning the bodies. All too often, many joined in the pyres themselves. The planet was a monument to the insanity of this period. It was a horrifying example of the very worst descent seen in the human condition. Brainwashed zealotry, extreme religious worship, and indoctrination of the military forces of the world. By the time contact with the Imperium was restored, Lestrati's population had plummeted from 14 billion to just 2.5 million. It's just a singular example of the kind of atrocities that Vandire allowed to take place under his reign, and they were endless, all of course being meticulously recorded by his scribes. The receipt of such news throughout the galaxy enthused him to waffle with endless speeches, condemning those he deemed enemies of the Imperium. All were meticulously recorded by the scribes. And then, of course, you come to one of the most infamous stories in the early period of the Reign of Blood. Vandire's spies had uncovered a small all-female cult on the agri-world of San Leor, named the Daughters of the Emperor. They were said to have an extreme and pure devotion to worshipping the Emperor through inner purity and lifelong martial training. For reasons best not speculated upon, Vandire was intrigued. He shifted from fury to ambition. With an entourage of nearly 100,000 servants and soldiers, he arrived upon San Leor, and personally led a massive procession, forcing locals to, of course, praise him under threat of death. Upon reaching the temple of the Daughters of the Emperor, Vandire was denied entry and told that the order did not recognize his authority. Ordinarily, this would have caused Vandire to react with immense rage, but bizarrely, he calmly demanded that they witness instead a demonstration proving he held the Emperor's favour. With a small guard contingent, Vandire entered the temple of the Daughters of the Emperor, and before their entire order knelt in prayer. He held tight his Rosarius. The daughters had no idea of what lay in his hands, and then Vandire issued a command to a nearby soldier to shoot him. The officer hesitated, but Vandire coldly replied, "I have the Emperor's protection. Do you doubt that?" Trapped by the threat, the guard fired, and a blinding flash of light filled the hall. But Vandire stood unharmed, leaning calmly on his cane. The Rosarius's hidden force field had saved him, It was a simple trick that he felt sure that the daughters of an isolated agri-world had no ability to reason or comprehend. Instead, awestruck, they knelt in worship. Vandaya seized the moment, demanding oaths of loyalty and elevating the order to his new personal guard, renaming them somewhat creepily the Brides of the Emperor. They would be now elevated to training in modern imperial warfare. They would become his ruthless protectors and silent assassins, believing him to be the true vessel for the Emperor to speak through. They would obey his every command without question or hesitation. And in this period, the daughters were beyond warriors. They served as his companions, tasting his food, nursing his frailty, and entertaining him. But through all of this, their loyalty was absolute. The Holy Synod, meanwhile, had grown considerably tired of the destruction caused by Vandaya, so much so that they plotted his assassination. But the brides discovered this, storming the council chamber. They sealed the doors and emerged later carrying the severed heads of every cardinal. Every attempt to remove Vandaya ended in the same result. So the horror then continued on for some 70 years, and while the worlds beyond the dark indulgences of Vandaya showcased the wealth of the Ministerium, on Terra itself, decay had set in. Vandaya had steadily disintegrated as a person, and so did the architecture, which crumbled, filth and detritus lay everywhere within poorly managed halls that had little to any oversight. Vandaya's interests were elsewhere. Vermin scurried across decaying carpets, and disturbing shadows swallowed the halls. In the vast dark chambers, only the faint flicker of a lone candle and the silent steps of the Brides of the Emperor hinted at any life. Vandaya himself was in a rotten state. He would sit for days on end in complete silence. His ancient body was so pumped full of drugs and elixirs to keep disease and the ravages of age at bay that he had little ability to do much else. With the guns of the Brides of the Emperor always ready to obey his will, the crippled High Lord still commanded with an iron fist. In his more lucid moments, Vandaya was bizarrely heard muttering about the light. The writings of his scribes recorded that his fear of light seemed to be growing with every passing day, which I think we can well interpret as to why. So when an agent of Vandaya returned to Terra with extremely alarming news, this was not well received. In the Northern Galaxy, a system which held the planet of Dimamar, Vandaya had been denounced publicly as a traitor. The source of this outrage, the long-thought destroyed Confederation of Light. They were apparently resurging. Central to this rebellion was a mysterious figure known as Sebastian Thor. The High Lords debated for weeks over the matter, and Vandaya was incapable of practical contributions, so consumed by rage and paranoia that he withdrew into isolation, guarded by the Brides of the Emperor. Steadily, more systems began pledging loyalty to Thor, and Vandaya, in a moment of clarity, ordered his elite Fratres Templars to exterminate all life on Dimamar. However, the war fleet was obliterated by a colossal warp storm near the Clax system. Later, this earned the title the Storm of the Emperor's Wrath. This catastrophic loss crippled the Ecclesiarchy's military power and triggered widespread rebellion as a result. Furious mobs stormed cardinal palaces, destroying icons and relics in a frenzy of vengeance. Amidst the chaos, Thor's name became a beacon of resistance and light. The High Lords were gripped by fear and speculated whether this Thor was a servant of chaos, a new Horus, or under even Xenos' influence. It was in fact all the more likely that they simply feared the significant accountability that was very quickly headed in their direction. Yet as more intelligence surfaced, the scale of Thor's uprising left them both stunned and uncertain of how to confront this growing threat, because of course they had no ability to confront this. Sebastian Thor was in actuality little more than a devout, unassuming man born in the privilege of a Schola Brigidium. He rose to power after claiming visions from the Emperor, which may or may not be true, and denounced the corrupt Ecclesiarchy. His unmatched charisma and powerful oratory skills ignited a massive rebellion, which was not an astonishing accomplishment in the circumstances. But this did grow his followers well into the multiple millions, and notably even included defectors from Vandaya's own forces in droves. Thor's influence spread. Entire systems abandoned the Ministerium for obvious reasons. His fleet continued toward Terra, mysteriously untouched by the warp, which again, we may or may not wish to draw conclusions from. As they advanced, they united a galaxy desperate for liberation under his leadership. So the disturbing news came for those forces and individuals aligned with the plight of Vandyr, that now even the Mechanicus and several Space Marine chapters had broke their long silence. Because for the longest time, they had been, not content perhaps, but they didn't want to weigh in and make things even worse. But now enough was enough. Many were demanding Vandyr's arrest and immediate execution. In response, Vandyr dissolved the High Lords and ordered attacks on the rebellious factions, executing officers who refused. The guardrails were off, and now anything and anybody was a potential target. But this may have been more of a threat in the mind of Vandyr than it was in reality, because they had far less military power than at the height of their reign. Upon hearing this, a now enraged Fabricator General chose to no longer abstain from taking a position. They would deploy Mechanicus regiments to Terra alongside the Imperial Fists, Firehawks, Soul Drinkers, and of course the Black Templars. For months, they besieged Vandyr's surprisingly resistant ecclesiarchal palace, but although his demise seemed inevitable, it would not be their assault that doomed him, for a now legendary threat was rising from within. During the reign of Vandyr, the Emperor's custodes had, as always, remained isolated within the Imperial Palace, focused solely on guarding the Golden Throne. It is worth noting that for the 10,000 years through to M41, the custodes rarely engaged off-world, and they largely stayed guarding the Emperor. So it's only in the more recent times that they've ventured significantly beyond the Terran Sol system. The custodes only learned of Vandyr's treachery, somewhat unbelievably, when the Space Marines and Adeptus Mechanicus arrived to move against him. In secret, the custodes became involved and assisted in strategically advising the ongoing assault, even taking some actions themselves. Using their typical hidden passages within the palace, a custodes contingent led by a centurion infiltrated deep into Vandyr's domain. There, they confronted the brides of the Emperor, calling for a parley. The centurion laid down his arms and pleaded for the brides to abandon Vandyr, warning they served a traitor, not the Emperor. Incredulously, the brides refused. So, leaving his men behind, the centurion guided their leader and a bodyguard of 5 female warriors back into the tunnels. The brides of the Emperor were soon lost within the dark, twisting maze, but the silent centurion led them unerringly into the heart of the Imperial Palace. Eventually, they would emerge into the dim light once more and were met by the companions who guarded the gate. This was the secret entrance to the chambers of the Golden Throne itself. The centurion explained what was happening and that the warrior women were about to enter the most sacred place in the galaxy. He would bring them before the Emperor himself. They were to see what no one but the Space Marine Primarchs and companions had seen since the close of the Heresy. But the centurion warned them of the dangers that lay within, and that to speak would be to die. Thereafter, he led them into the golden light spilling from the open portal. As is often the case for those who enter the chamber of the Emperor, what they saw was never recorded or recounted. Of course, it is rumoured that they did witness the Emperor himself, but what passed between them and the companions remains also a matter of myth. All that really matters is that when they stepped from the gate once more, their eyes burned with a pious fire, a raging inferno of unparalleled anger and hatred. Silently, they were led back from the audience chamber. Their leader, Alicia Dominica, spoke of the treachery of Vandyr and his depraved corruption of the Ecclesiarchy. But most of all, she spoke of the outrage at the twisted perversion of their order. Burning with shame and anger, they renounced the name of the brides and once again became the daughters of the Emperor. Soon after, in Vandyr's vast chamber where he conducted all his plans and strategic commands, he found himself suddenly very alone, surrounded only by the daughters of the Emperor. Alicia Dominica stood before Vandyr, her voice resolute and unwavering, her words now etched into the black marble of her sarcophagus, condemned him. "You have committed the ultimate heresy. Not only have you turned your back on the Emperor and stepped from his light, you have profaned his name and almost destroyed everything he has striven to build. You have perverted and twisted the path he has laid for mankind to tread. As your own decrees have stated, there can be no mercy for such a crime, no pity for such a criminal. I renounce your lordship. You walk in the darkness and cannot be allowed to live. Your sentence has long been overdue, and now it is time for you to die. Raising her power sword high, Dominica stood ready. Vandyr, glancing at the warriors around him, frowned in confusion. Shaking his head, he whispered his infamous final words. I don't have time to die. I'm too busy. With a single decisive stroke, Dominica's blade fell, beheading the traitor and cleaving his Rosarius symbolically in two. Though Vandyr's death ended the Reign of Blood, the Age of Apostasy persisted for centuries. Warp storms and fragmented power vacuums left much of the Imperium in chaos. Rogue Imperial commanders and cardinals still attempted to resist, carving out their own realms. The Space Marine Chapter Masters and Fabricated General worked to rebuild the High Lords, using Vandyr's records to expose and prosecute collaborators. Many factions purged their own ranks, loyal Imperial commanders were promoted, even High Lords were vindicated, retaining their seats. But the position of Ecclesiarch remained unsurprisingly vacant. Having been repeatedly summoned to Terra, Sebastian Thor refused the High Lord's demands, which did not sit well with them. Thor insisted that his work in the Northern Galactic Reaches was unfinished. Those upon Terra were frustrated that after their endless issues with Vandyr, their commands were still not being given the true authority they should carry. They instead declared Thor a traitor and ordered his arrest. Thor, of course, peacefully surrendered and urged his followers to trust in the Emperor and to not rise up. As he arrived upon Terra, his trial drew hundreds of thousands from across Terra and the Imperium. They filled the Judicium Terran with supporters. And I know it may seem unbelievable for the Imperium of all things to hold anything one might consider a fair trial, but apparently in this instance that was the case. Because when all was said and done, despite aggressive prosecution, every charge against Thor was disproved. He had neither incited violence nor resisted Imperial forces. After 2 months, the High Lords deliberated for days, but they still felt disrespected and heavily resisted, wanting to reward Thor. In many ways, I think they just feared yet again another rogue Ecclesiarch. But eventually, as we have seen many times, it would be the Custodes who finally put the hammer down. Captain General Excelsor of the Adeptus Custodes delivered the verdict. Thor was innocent, and in the Imperium spiritual crisis, must become the Ecclesiarch. But still, Thor humbly refused, incredulously. Chaos, of course, erupted, and Excelsor quietly pulled him aside, reportedly saying, "You will leave Terra as Ecclesiarch, or you will not leave at all." With Vandyr's death and Thor's installation as Ecclesiarch, order slowly did return to the Imperium. Vandyr's oppressive reforms were dismantled, along with his political power base. Under Thor, the Confederation of Light, as it was called, replaced the Temple of the Saviour Emperor in its corrupt now theology. Yet the overall title of Adeptus Ministrorum remained, and the Church's focus shifted from political dominance to broad spiritual guidance. Most critically, Thor issued the Decree Passive, disbanding the militant Fraternis Templar and forbidding the Ecclesiarchy from controlling any men under arms. However, exploiting a, let's be real, quite absurd loophole, he transformed the Daughters of the Emperor into the Adepta Sororitas. They would become the new order's militant, known as the Sisters of Battle, to defend the Waith and wage sanctioned wars of faith, because of course they were not men under arms. Although the High Lords were not entirely comfortable with this, Thor did rationalise that the Ministerium required some branch of military to defend itself and not be at the whims and future actions of rogue Imperial departments. The High Lords had little recourse, and so the Sisters remained through to the contemporary Imperium. Quietly alongside all of this, to prevent future tyranny, two new Inquisition branches were created. the Ordo Hereticus, charged with rooting out internal threats to the Emperor's will, and the Ordo Sicarius, tasked with policing the Officia Assassinorum. The Sisters of Battle became the chamber militant of the Ordo Hereticus also, pledging their ultimate loyalty to the Emperor through the Inquisition, ensuring that the Ministerium could never again overreach with its power. At the age of 112, Sebastian Thor returned to Terra. He was to live for another 6 months, before finally the Emperor reclaimed his soul. A massive wing was built onto the Mausoleum of Remembrance to contain his sarcophagus. The week after his death was declared a period of mourning, and over 70 million pilgrims filed past his tomb just within the first year. Huge murals commemorating his life and works adorn the 3-mile-long passageway leading up to his burial chamber, and the people of the Imperium still travel to Terra to gaze upon the face of the Emperor's most faithful servant, even now in M41. Now, I really want to see a series exploring the apostasy, but not because it's just the Sisters of Battle origin series, but because it could cut deep to the core of everything that is the very best aspects of what 40k has to offer. I have sometimes heard it rumoured that anything between M31 and M41 will never be explored, which I think is one both wrong already and absolutely outrageous. Because when it comes to some of this background material, the dice need to be rolled. Exploration of the apostasy must happen. It's one of the most dark and compelling, yet astonishingly underexplored eras of 40k. Who would not want to hear stories that dive into the characters in this bleak, horrifying landscape of unchecked corruption, religious fanaticism, and brutal civil war? It's a time when the Imperium of Man once again is brought to the very edge of total collapse, but not to be torn apart by Xenos or demonic incursions, but by its own institutions, decaying and abused from within. The apostasy is an amazing fusion of political intrigue, ideological conflict, physical warfare. You've got one of the most nightmarish antagonists in Ghost Vandire, a paranoid megalomaniac wielding absolute power over the Administratum and the Ecclesiarchy. We would get to see the sprawling tale of how he twists the Imperium into an ever more nightmarish theocracy drenched in its own blood. The disturbing manipulation of the faithful. We can well imagine the scenes that could describe an emotionally charged, morally complex narrative in the Daughters and the Brides of the Emperor's journey also, through to their reformation as the Sororitas. Imagine the harrowing story that follows one among their number, where she is torn between devotion to the Emperor and the uncomfortable requests and actions of Vandire that they feel so obligated to remain loyal to. Then eventually, in their awakening to the horrifying truth, the eventual redemption, the unleashing of wrath upon him, and any others who are just guilty by association. We finally see their transformation into the Emperor's true warriors. It's an unbelievably powerful character arc of betrayal, faith, salvation. And this is surely just one fragment of what could be explored. Adjacent to this, you've got Sebastian Thor, perfect counterbalance to Vandire's tyranny, a man of humble origins wielding only his unshakable faith and charisma to ignite a rebellion. We would follow his journey from an unknown preacher to the saviour of the Imperium. That's the story I want to hear. Beyond this, you have just the larger political backdrop of the Imperium, the High Lords of Terra, fractured and impotent under Vandire's grip, the surprisingly absent but ultimately critical role of the Custodes, and of course you need to have some following which charts the involvement of Space Marines and Mechanicus, but I feel even this could be done with an interesting angle. You could focus on them being hesitant instead of proactive to want to get involved in this tinderbox situation, because even though millennia have passed, many are still going to have the heresy still firmly in mind. Throughout it all, we could have the seeds which eventually germinate into the formation of the Ordo Hereticus rising out of the ashes of Vandire's reign. For me, it's one of the greatest untold chapters of Imperial history, for the Age of Apostasy is not just a story of war, it's the story of human belief, faith, power, and the consequences of blind devotion to a demagogue figure. It's a perfect stage to explore the oppressive weight of the Imperium's dogma, paired with the all-too-human, ever-problematic lust for power, and the immense sacrifices and cost required to then reclaim a shattered empire again. And if you also think that this story of faith, the corrupted and redeemed, the institutions crumbling and reforged in fire, humanity standing upon the edge of annihilation once again, is one which deserves to be further explored and expanded upon, then as always, tell me your thoughts about this down in the comments. Please like this video, share it far and wide, and join me in the firm belief that this is a chapter of the Imperium and 40K galaxy which needs and demands to be told.